Welcome back to More Front Wing, where today we're very lucky to have a special interview. We're joined this morning by the president of competition for IndyCar, Mr. Brian Barnhart. Brian, thanks so much for taking some time out to speak with us this morning before you head off to Brazil.
My pleasure, Paul and Steph. Thanks for having me.
Well, Brian, obviously, last time we spoke at Chicago, we spoke then about penalties coming out of Edmonton. Here we are 6 or 8 months later, we're speaking about penalties again, this time coming out of Chicago. What I want to get at here, and what I want to have you on the record and allow you to speak to the fans directly, because we've heard some different things from different people, but we haven't heard yet from you specifically. So before we get started in the specific stuff about Long Beach, we want to get a little bit broader view of how race control works and what exactly goes on there. We know there's a four-person team there that's made up of yourself and Allender Jr., Tony Kottman, and Bill Van de Zandt. Can you take us through a little bit of the dynamic of what goes on in race control? What's the general role of everyone there? Do all four of the gentlemen in there kind of have equal say in the decisions that go on?
Well, ultimately the decision is mine, but they all have equal ability to weigh in and certainly give their opinions. If I find myself in a position with simply too many things taking place at the same time, it's not uncommon for me to turn to any of the other three and say, guys, take a look at that and let me know what you think. And I have the trust and faith in them to make those decisions and determinations. It's a bit of a challenge, guys, simply because it is a fairly unique sport in that we don't have timeouts. We don't have the ability to stop the competition and review and replay something like the NFL does, or, you know, Major League Baseball reviewing home runs and stuff like that. Our event is on the fly all the time, and decisions need to be made in a timely fashion, in a timely manner. And, you know, it is a challenging environment in there and varies from venue to venue. Basically, what I'm saying from that aspect, doing road and street events is considerably different than doing oval track events. Most of the oval track events, race control is on the outside of the racetrack right at start-finish line, and you can see the entire racetrack. Most of the road and street events, I can't even see any segment of the racetrack. At Long Beach being the example, we actually do it from a locker room in the Long Beach Arena, and we are totally dependent on what television cameras are showing us. And that becomes a bit of a challenge because they don't always show us what we would like to see or what, you know, is the action point around the racetrack for a variety of reasons, whether the cameraman chooses to follow a different car or whatnot. So we've got multiple video screens in there on several television sets that show us on road courses upwards of 12 to 16 camera views, depending on the number of corners, number of cameras. Bill Van de Zandt and Tony Kottman specifically monitor our digital video recording equipment, which includes those cameras as well as the onboard cameras of the cars that are carrying cameras at that event. And Allender Jr. and I focus on the screens that are watching and carrying the event live. We have Jim Swintall as our voice on race control and relays the commands to all the pit techs, the teams, the pace car driver, the starter, the flagman, all that stuff. Jim Norman is our fire control, and he's talking to the wreckers, the ambulances, the track safety guys, and cleanup trucks, sweepers, that kind of stuff. Dave Price is our main communicator with our corner worker network and observer network, talking to our network of people around the racetrack that are relaying information back on a landline or radio back to him with regards to track and car conditions. So that's kind of the makeup of the people in there and what their roles are.
So, Brian, can you walk us through precisely what the procedure is for initiating and reviewing investigation of an incident?
Well, basically, I mean, if you get a contact between two or more cars on the racetrack, you need to find out why and what happened. So initially you'll see it on the screen live, or hopefully you will. If you don't, if something has happened and we see cars sitting sideways, a contact has taken place, then I will turn to Tony and Bill on the video replays and the digital video recorders and see if they can go find it on somebody's camera to try and review what happened on it and see if to see what initiated and triggered the contact on the situation. And, you know, I think it's important as well for people to get a better understanding of what the rules are, what the interpretation, what the expectations are, and then what the penalties are. Because I think when you have a full understanding of that, it is, at least in my opinion, of course it would be my opinion, race control has been extremely fair and extremely consistent with our enforcement of the rules all year long. And I think the important part is that if you have a driver that is, you know, trying to improve his or her position on the racetrack, and in doing so, attempts to make a pass in an illegal, unsafe, careless, or reckless fashion, or an unsportsmanlike maneuver that results in contact with another car, that's when we will initiate a review to see if it was avoidable contact, to see if this person advantaged their position in the race in an unsportsmanlike maneuver. And that's what we're looking for. And if you go back and look at the course of the season, we've had 6 incidents that race control has seen or tried to review and rule on whether there was avoidable contact or not. Once you make that determination, the other important aspect is to remember what the penalty is for consistent enforcement. And if the track condition is green, the penalty is a drive-through penalty through the pits at the pit lane speed limit. If we've gone full course caution as a result of the contact, the instigating or offending driver is moved to the back of the field. And that's the penalties for the offending car. If you go back and look at those 6 incidents, you know, the first one starts with Elio in turn 1 of lap 1 at St. Pete. And multi-car accident initiated by Elio and his contact with Marco. We go full course caution, obviously, so the penalty would be Elio at the back of the line. Well, there's no ability to enforce that penalty. His car's on the wrecker. It goes back to the tent, and he spends 20 to 25 laps in the garage area affecting repairs on his car while the race resumed without him. There is no penalty to be had at that point in time. He has, in effect, penalized himself worse than what the race control penalty would be. He's down many, many laps. Later in the race, you had Danica running 12th and J.R. Hildebrand running 11th. And on the last lap of the race, in fact, they were 11th and 12th. They were the last 2 cars on the lead lap. And, in fact, the 13th place car was 2 laps behind them. So they had a 2-lap advantage on the next car behind them. And going into turn 10, Danica roots around Hildebrand, turns him around in turn 10 with her nose onto his left rear. The checkered flag comes out, so there's no opportunity for us to do a drive-through penalty. So the only penalty can be the equivalent of putting her at the back of the line as it finishes and crosses the start-finish line, which gives Hildebrand back the position of 11th, moves her back to 12th, but does not move her back any further than that because the 13th place cars and on down were 2 or more laps behind her. But again, it was consistent with the ruling and the placement of her in the field. You go to Barber and Hunter Ray and Briscoe get together in turn 8, battling for 3rd place. Hunter Ray continues. Briscoe has broken suspension, ends up in the sand trap. We go full course caution to dig him out. His event is concluded. And clearly, you know, Hunter Ray's attempting to make a pass and in our opinion was ruled avoidable contact. We're under a full course caution. That ruling is made, and Hunter Ray goes to the back of the line. Again, consistent with what we're doing. You move on to Long Beach and the situation with Castroneves and Wilson in turn 11. Again, people have got to look at and understand what the rules are. And the rule for avoidable contact is if a driver is attempting to improve his or her position or attempting to overtake another car in an unsafe fashion or an unsportsmanlike fashion, Elio was not attempting to pass. They were running nose to tail. He was following Wilson through the corner. He did not make a dive bomb attempt into turn 11 to try and pass him. In addition to that, upon the review, Justin's onboard camera shows how much Justin was struggling with his car's handling through turn 10. And when Al and Tony reviewed Justin's onboard camera, you see him oversteering in turn 10 two or three times and on and off the throttle. And with Elio in that close proximity behind him, with his nose tucked right up underneath his gearbox, they touched, made contact, spun him around. But in race control's determination, it was not a careless, reckless maneuver and not an overtaking attempt. It was ruled just a racing incident of contact, so no penalty was called for. In race control's opinion, none was deserved. Now, just a few laps later, when you look at Tracy's situation, and I guess, again, reminding the drivers themselves, and I know the fans and the media aren't always in the drivers' meetings, but in the drivers' meeting, we talked about turn 11 and told them, guys, 999 out of 1,000 pass attempts in turn 11 will result in contact. It is not a place you even want to try an overtaking or a passing attempt. Don't do it. You will just risk contact and get somebody turned around. It's not a passing zone on the racetrack. Use your heads in turn 11. Tracy was attempting to pass a car in turn 11, overshot that car, made contact with Simona, turned her around. By very definition, attempting to improve his position in a careless and reckless and unsafe and unsportsmanlike fashion, he makes contact with another car. Result, full course caution. He's moved to the back of the line, just like Hunter Ray was, just like Danica was, and just like Elio would have been previously. So, again, we're totally consistent. Later in the race, when Elio gets into power, running for third, going down into turn one, and spins both of them out, they both stall. Again, we go full course caution, and by the time we restarted both cars, they were both at the back of the line. Now, a determination for Elio to be the instigator and cause of avoidable contact, the penalty would put him at the back of the field. He was at the back of the field by the time we restarted him and sent him around. And, you know, race control at that time doesn't make an announcement and say, three car back of the line, you look like an idiot, he's already back there. So, again, when you look at the contact and situations we have, the determination and the interpretation, the offending car has ended up in the exact same place in all five instances. It has been at the back of the line or in the garage making repairs to their own damaged car. So the whole point and aspect of consistency and enforcement, it really kind of boggles my mind how people see it that way, to be honest with you guys. And I know I talked a long time there, so fire away.
Well, Brian, I think that the one thing that hasn't been addressed in your comments is the fact that a lot of fans are commenting that even in the situations where the car does end up already at the back of the line or already in the garage, that it would be nice to see race control issue a penalty in those situations just to see that race control has reviewed the situation and put a penalty on record, so that when we're looking throughout the season at where drivers have had infractions and when, that there's a clear paper trail to follow. Have you given any consideration to those comments?
I think that's highly redundant, to be honest with you. Like I say, I mean, knowing what the penalties are for avoidable contact and that the resulting car ends up there, there's so much going on in race control, I don't think we need to waste our breath or say something that is so painfully obvious and redundant, like three cars been penalized, go to the back of the line. When you say that and he's already there, it makes you look foolish.
Brian, how much does a driver's reputation or the team that they're with or their history as a driver, does that come into play at all in considering the penalties that are handed out to a driver during the race?
I don't know. If it does, there may be subconsciously coming into it. I mean, some people have a different reputation, obviously, other than others. And to be honest with you, I think over the course of time, I think some of them earn a shorter leash than others, based on their actions on the racetrack. If they have a history, if they're prone to contact and overly aggressive driving, you tend to maybe be a little, like I say, shorter with the leash on them and more quick to make a determination than someone that hasn't had contact with somebody in 3 years and they happen to have one. You know, it's not a driving pattern or a typical behavior, you know, demonstration or pattern that they put on the racetrack. So you do your best to look at each individual incident as it happens, but I'm sure there's some of it in the back of your mind that sits there and says, boy, this guy's been involved in 7 incidents already this year and blah, 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 that kind of stuff. So you can get into that pattern for sure.
The article that Marshall Pruitt put out last week when he spoke with Allinger Jr. following a lot of this, I don't have the quote in front of me, but there was an insinuation, if not a direct quote, that race control felt that whatever we did to Elio, as you had said, he was already at the back of the line, whatever we did would kind of be not as significant as what Roger Penske himself would do, having had 2 of his cars taken out in the same incident. And again, I'm paraphrasing there, and I don't mean that to be an exact quote. That was the gist of what he said, I think. Did that come into play in the determination of what was going to happen? Did race control feel that's part of Roger Penske's responsibility to take care of this incident that happened between 2 of his own drivers?
I don't think that rule comes into our rulings at all. I don't think that plays into our decision making at all. I think it's a natural to happen when 2 teammates get together, but no different than when we penalized Elio at Edmonton last year. That was his transgression was against a teammate, just as Long Beach was against a teammate as well. So the penalties again are consistently enforced. Just because it's a teammate doesn't mean we don't enforce the rules. And just as we did at Edmonton and just as the effect was at Long Beach where he ended up, I haven't seen the comment or read the article you're referring to either, and if there's something in there, then, you know, I can't address it. That's speculation on my part as well. But it's only natural that when you have teammates get together, there's an expectation that after the event, I'm sure the owner is going to try and look for an explanation and try and make sure it doesn't happen again in the future. That's not in any team's best interest to have teammates taking each other out, but it certainly doesn't affect our decisions in race control.
Well, Brian, you've been very thorough on the discussion of the penalties here, and I just want to clear up one thing before we leave this topic. You had mentioned the thought of passing in turn 11. We've seen some releases of some of your notes where you specifically said turn 11 shouldn't be considered a no passing zone. Is that something that you've done before, where you've given at least guidance, if not an outright rule that says this specific spot on the track isn't considered passing, and if you do make a mistake here, you will be penalized? Are there other places throughout the season where that precedent has been in effect?
Turn 11 at Long Beach is about the most prevalent, I guess, of the situations you're describing there. I can't think of any others off the top of my head. The discussions even around turn 11 go so far as, you know, we talk about it each of the last couple of years at Long Beach. We've had discussions prior to the event beginning. Some of the drivers request that turn 11 be a standing yellow every lap of every session, including the race, because they don't want drivers to attempt to pass. Again, and I know we don't get much credit for actually thinking things through, but we, believe it or not, we really do. The challenge with that is that, as I've told the drivers, okay, so how are we going to mark this? If we agree and we make this a no-passing zone, because as you can see in my notes from there, I said, guys, 999 out of 1,000 attempted passes are going to result in contact. That's not good odds. Don't make a pass attempt there. If that's the case, you know, if we're going to actually hang a standing yellow, then you've got to have a line where that zone begins, because if somebody's coming through turn 10 and attempting a pass, then you have to have a point where that pass has to be completed by, or they have to move back behind them. You know what I'm saying? You know, if you're gonna create a standing no passing zone, you have to clearly define where it begins, and any passes have got to be completed prior to that line. And also, in addition to that, and as I've asked these drivers, okay, you literally want the corner worker to stand there and hang a yellow flag out every lap. Well, when somebody comes around that corner and spins sideways, and you're the next car on the scene, and that guy's waving that yellow flag, are you thinking he's just waving that yellow flag because it's a no-passing zone? How are you going to know the difference? There's actually a disabled car in an unsafe condition in front of you. So there's a number of reasons why we haven't officially made turn 11 a no-passing zone, but we've made it clear in each of the last couple, 3 years there, guys, you are just not making a good decision. The tightest, slowest, most difficult, challenging part of the racetrack to attempt to pass is followed by the longest straightaway and the best passing zone on the racetrack. If you will just stay tucked in behind them and take your chances down a 2,900-foot-long front straightaway with a heavy braking into turn one, you have much better chance there than you do in turn 11. It just simply boils down to these guys have got to make good decisions in a race car.
So this edict, if you will, or certainly this recommendation at worst, this was not something new to the drivers this year at Long Beach and, you know, something that they themselves had actually asked for or clamored for. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Brian, before we let you go, we know you're short on time, but we do need to touch on restarts. Was the double file restart situation considered acceptable at Long Beach by race control?
It's again one of those really challenging racetracks. Get guys around the corner. We took an awful lot of time on Thursday and Friday in dealing with the driver advisory group on where the line should be for acceleration. You know, I thought we did a much better job at Barber than we did at St. Pete on the formation, the form up, the speed, the spacing, the gaps, all that kind of stuff. But I think, unfortunately, a huge contributor to the improvement at Barber over St. Pete was the track geometry. And conversely, the track geometry at Long Beach, that hairpin, turn 11, is simply a single-file corner no matter what we do. And when you come off of that corner, you've only got about 800 feet prior to the start-finish line. And when they're single-file, it doesn't give them much time to jump out of that corner and form up. You know, in fact, we had even tried to split the difference with where the line was and the acceleration point. The initial start was even worse than I had thought or hoped it was going to be. However, again, you don't have a lot of television views and show us everything that we're looking for all the way back. They focus on a handful of cars. The start wasn't real good, so the reaction that we made, we took the pace car off into the back door at turn 10 on the initial start of the race. After seeing what the start looked like and trying to improve the restarts, slowing the front of the field down and trying to improve the ability to get more rows lined up, we kept the pace car out for all restarts all the way through turn 11 and brought him in the front door of pit opening just as all cars pitted. It was marginal in the difference that it made. Just it's so difficult to get guys around the corner in there and get them lined up in the double file formation. And, you know, the challenging aspect of it with turn one being what it is down in Long Beach, there was a lot of agreement amongst the drivers that if there was an issue in terms of where it looked worse, they would rather it look worse coming out of 11 than have it look bad in turn one where we would have a stack up or a red flag situation because we've blocked the track with a big crash down there. And yeah, that some of that, like I say, is just a result of the dynamics and geometry of that racetrack that are pretty unique with that hairpin over there. And, you know, we're going to have some challenges this weekend at Brazil from that standpoint. We've got another hairpin down there, and I think they can go too wide around that hairpin. It's wide enough to do it, and the straightaway is longer. The challenge is going to be turn one at Brazil is a very slow and tricky corner. The only attempt at double file start was the initial start last year, and we ended up with somebody on some guy's head. So it's a tricky situation down there as well.
Well, to that end, was there any was there any consideration given to moving the start-finish line a little bit away from the hairpin, or even maybe look at starting the race on the backstretch somewhat like you would do at a Mid-Ohio?
There's a lot, again, guys, there's a lot of dominoes getting knocked over and doing that. There's a lot of people that pay money in those suites and those front grandstand tickets to watch the start of the race. I mean, that's part of the reason you start Mid-Ohio in the back, is that's where all the fans are. And they want to see it down there. It isn't just from a safety or a location standpoint. It's where the fans are, and they want to see, what is it, turn four at Mid-Ohio. It becomes the first turn of the race under green flag conditions. Same thing, you restart under the bridge down the back between 8 and 9 at Long Beach, nobody's going to see it. So I don't think that's fair to the fans to do it that way as well. In terms of moving the start-finish line, again, that's not easy, guys. There's a lot of dominoes that get knocked over that people don't give a lot of consideration to. And when you're dealing with city streets, if you're going to move start-finish lines, we've got to cut up a lot of racetrack and replace timelines that help us know where drivers have improved positions or not. And getting cooperation and closing city streets to install timelines is not an easy thing to do, and it's a very time-consuming, expensive thing to do just to move it for that aspect of it. So it's never a simple situation. It's pretty complex.
One more question, because like I said, I know you're short on time. I got one final question on this topic. When we spoke last year at Chicago, you had mentioned that when you did wave off a restart, I believe you specifically mentioned Indianapolis, how you almost wadded up half the field a couple years ago. What are the considerations that you have to go through on the spur of the moment when you decide if you're going to allow a start or a restart to stand, and what would cause you to wave off a start or a restart?
Well, that's one of the byproducts of the change that's been implemented in what we're doing, and based on the feedback from the teams and the drivers, they've virtually come to a unanimous conclusion that in the interest of safety, with us being double file and how we're doing these restarts now, that we will go each and every time. We will not waive off any starts. What we will do is penalize someone who has either changed lanes or improved their position prior to the start-finish line. So there isn't much consideration given anymore to waiving off. What we're looking for is to see if people have changed lanes prior to the start-finish line and gotten out of formation, or if they've improved their position relative to a car in a row in front of them prior to the start-finish line. We don't look too much within individual rows. We need the leader to make sure he hits start-finish line before the other car on the front row. But everybody else, like if you're in the fifth or sixth row, if you're in the fifth row, I don't really care if 10th is in front of 9th or 9th is in front of 10th. That's just kind of the yin and yang of the two columns, if you will. I need to make sure the leader hits start-finish line first. All the other rows can be plus one or minus one relative to cars within their row. You cannot improve your position relative to any car in a row in front of you.
You just mentioned that you didn't care if, you know, second was, or I think you said 9th was in front of 10th or vice versa there. But as I recall, was there not a penalty at Barber last year where Scott Dixon, I believe it was Scott Dixon or Marco Andretti, was penalized? I believe they were in the second row at that time. Do you recall that situation?
Actually, that was Dixon last year at Barber, and he had passed a car that started in the second row.
Okay.
So, but again, those rules are a little different this year because of how we're restarting.
Okay.
So that's kind of a fresh approach with three races under our belt, trying to adapt to a significant change in procedures.
Very well. Well, Brian, I know you're extremely busy, and I know you're ready to hop on a plane here to Brazil later today, so I want to thank you very much for taking some time to join us and speak directly to some of these concerns of the fans and that have been raised in the media over the last couple of weeks, specifically from the race at Long Beach.
My pleasure, Paul. Good to talk to you and Steph as well. And anything I can do to help you guys, let me know in the future.
All right, very well. Well, best of luck this week in Brazil, and we'll look forward to catching up with you during the month of May at Indianapolis as well.
All right, thanks, guys.
All right, thanks, Brian. Take care.